And we're live. How's everybody doing today? Hope you all are hanging in there, holding close those dear to you. Today we have Aziz Abusar on the program. I'm actually very excited to have you on, Aziz. This is the second time Aziz has been on. For those who don't know, Aziz is a Palestinian peace activist from Jerusalem. He's former chairman of the Bereaved Families Forum, and he worked in conflict zones around the world, including Afghanistan and Syria. Is the author of Crossing Boundaries, A Traveler's Guide to World Peace. Aziz, it's so good to have you on. How are you doing?
Thank you, Adar. It's very hard to really answer that. It's been a horrific few days. And I think if you're a peace activist, it's even worse, because if you on the Israeli side or the Palestinian side and you see things black and white, you have one horrific pain. But if you connect it to both, you're feeling the pain of everyone around you, and it's so much. So I have friends in Israel who've lost family members, friends, everyone I talked to in the last couple of days are going in and out of funerals. Which is heartbreaking. I know some of the people who've been hurt or are missing, kidnapped. And then I have friends in Gaza who are going through hell right now as well. And some who lost already family members as well through this. So it's just unfathomable to comprehend everything that's happening.
Yeah, I'm so sorry to hear for your losses. It's quite devastating. It's, you know, something many people from the outside don't really understand about this conflict, and how small the land of Israel Palestine is that there's not a single person who's not affected. There's not a single person who hasn't lost people to this conflict. Just going through my timeline on social media, I have at least a dozen friends who have shared photos of loved ones who have been killed or are missing. So the toll is not just on those dead, it's really on those, the entire country, the inhabitants of both nations. You mentioned it's a tough time now to be a peace activist. I feel like one of the things that I find to be very unfortunate is how ridiculed and mocked peacemakers are on both sides, right? Like, there's so much pride in our militarism. Soldiers are praised and highly respected. But if you're a peacemaker, at the least, you'll just be seen as naive, but at the most, you'll be laughed at. And I imagine that's probably even to a greater extent on the Palestinian side. What's your experience really being a Palestinian peace activist, and how do people respond to the work you do, especially during these times?
Yeah, I think what you say, naive, is sometimes the words people refer to, ignoring reality, not being able to see straight, normalizers, another word some people would use. But the thing is, I mean, even now, like you said, I've been very outspoken about what happened, saying I think this is not resistance. Going killing civilians is absolutely not resistance, and vice versa. I don't think bombing Gaza will help in any way. And it's, to me, amazing that those voices, what we're saying in these times, those few of us, are sounding naive, even though for the last how many years of this conflict, nobody has followed our advice on how to make things better. Military violence, killing, has been the way of how to do things. And 70 plus years later, it has not brought us quiet. It has not brought us stability. It has not brought us peace. It has not brought us justice. It has not brought us freedom. And yet we are seen are the ones who are naive. I think,
right.
Maybe, yeah. If somebody listened to what we're trying to say a few years back, couple of years back, we wouldn't be here. And the fact nobody would try to consider peacemaking as the target instead of military violence. It's absurd that we still call the naive ones.
Yeah, that's a great point. And, you know, it's really something that I've been reflecting on a lot. And this is true about both sides, how they treat one another. But when there were the attack on October 7th in the South, you know, I was devastated for two reasons. One, just the loss of innocent lives, including people who I know. But also, I knew for a fact that Palestinians are going to get it worse now, right? It's for every Israeli civilian that got murdered, there's going to be multiple Palestinian civilians in the upcoming weeks that will be killed. And
it doesn't bring more security to Israel, you know?
Well, I mean, this has really been our approach. Every few years, we bomb the shit out of Gaza, and all we really have to show for it is a more popular and stronger Hamas, a more radicalized Palestinian population, and a lot of dead children. So, and you know, we always say like we have the right to self-defense, but if our attacks on Gaza doesn't defeat Hamas and doesn't change the status quo, then it's not self-defense, it's retribution. So, you know, I don't think that, you know, we often talk, you know, Hamas intentionally targeted civilians and we target militants and civilians are collateral damage. And I do think that there's a difference there because intention does matter. But if we know for a fact that civilians are going to be killed and we could assess the result of these civilians dying, that it's not actually going to defeat Hamas and they get stronger and more funding, then I don't think we have the moral high ground to the extent that many claim we do. But, you know, what I was thinking after this happened, how many people were cheering on Hamas and the Palestinians? And I just asked myself, why are you cheering on an action that's going to result in so much destruction for Palestinians? Even if you think Israel deserves it, let's say you think Israelis deserve it, fine. But you are supporting and cheering for an action that's going to cause the death of hundreds, likely even thousands of Palestinian civilians. How could you cheer for that? Now, there's these activists around the world that they cheer for it because I think they actually hate Israel more than they love Palestine. So it's easy for them to cheer for it. But I'm wondering amongst Palestinian society why they cheer for it. Like, is it out of desperation that any change is good change? Like, what do you make of that?
I think there's a mix. There's a mix of things. One, the moment you see one person cheering for it, there are cameras, and that one person becomes the representation of Palestinians. I didn't see, for example, much celebration in the West Bank at all. I've followed, and I really haven't seen any. And yet the way we hear about it, as of everybody in the West Bank has been out celebrating. There were some people who were happy with it, don't get me wrong. But it wasn't like mass numbers of people going out and dancing in the streets and so on all over. In Gaza, I think a lot of people are hurting. A lot of people feel there's no future. And the Arab mentality, in some way, we've lost to Israel so many times. Arab countries couldn't handle Israel more than 6 days, the Six-Day War. And that what Hamas has done was more inflicting more pain on Israel than any other Arab country. And in some ways, it becomes kind of what you are saying. It becomes, if I can get you to suffer more than me, even if it's for a day, that's some kind of victory. I personally think that's nonsense. That's ridiculous.
Right.
Making you suffer doesn't make my case, doesn't help me, and who's suffering? It's not even, you're talking about people, and this is how the disconnect is. You're talking about some of the most pro-Palestinian communities probably in Israel. You're talking about people who live in kibbutzes, who are, some of them I know were driving Palestinians to hospitals, people I know who are in protests literally every week, people who are part of peace organizations. These are people who I personally know, people who would go out and protest with us. You think making those people suffer, gonna help Palestinian cause. But then I remember nobody in Gaza knows these people. The only people we know in Israel are soldiers, and they think, and this is a disconnect. They think every Israeli is part of the system of occupation, and therefore, if I can make them suffer, maybe, you know, that in Hebrew you say, what doesn't go with violence goes with more violence.
Right.
It's the same. Right. It's like, oh, let's show them we can be also strong and violent without thinking almost of the day after. And the ones who are dying now in Gaza are not the ones who made those decisions, are not the ones who supported this, are not, you know, it's kids. 50% of Gaza are kids.
It's right.
And they're the ones who pay the highest price for this.
You know, it was, I saw a post yesterday and it said those innocent, in parentheses, in quotations, those innocent kids killed in Gaza, those innocent kids in Gaza in 2014 were the same adults that carried out this attack. And I actually view that as a form of an own goal, because they're trying to make it seem like the kids aren't innocent because they'll grow up to be terrorists. But because they were kids who endured massive airstrikes and trauma, they're much more likely to grow up as adults that are willing to commit heinous crimes against the other side, regardless of if they're militants or civilians. That's the unseen cost of war, the trauma and the radicalization of our populations. And it's hard not to lose hope, because with each wave of violence, we are more traumatized, we are more radicalized. I've never seen this many Israelis and pro-Israel people call for genocide against Palestinians. And I know that, you know, there's no shortage of people that are, there's an increased amount of people that are calling for continued violence against Israelis and against Israeli civilians.
You're right. Look, part of the reason we are where we are today is the Second Intifada. The violence, the suicide bombings have made more and more young Israelis grow up being very anti-peace, anti-Palestinians, and the people in the West Bank and people in Gaza who experienced also horrific violence and grew up to be much less supportive of peace. And that's how we end up in these cycles of violence again and again, because it's a self-fulfilling prophecy in some ways. They're violent, we violent, they do violence, we do violence. That just it doesn't break if we continue. And yeah, you can kill a million people in Gaza. You think in the next 10 years, the next generation will be any more peaceful? It's not how it works. I think we got to learn that violence is not the way. But I have a question for you. I go on social media, unfortunately, every now and then. And what I am amazed, maybe more than ever, a couple of things. One, the amount of misinformation or disinformation, maybe, going on, where I have a hard time believing even the people who put it out don't know this is purely lying for a cause. And I see it from every side. And then I started noticing who the people who posting most of those things. And actually, it's majority are not even Israelis or Palestinians who are living in the West Bank or Gaza. Majority are people from abroad who are doing that. Some of them Jews, some of them Arabs, but majority are people not even living in the area.
Out of all the conflicts, this is the most misinformation I've seen. And I don't know if I'm just more aware this time, but there's a baffling amount. So I think the people spreading it, I don't think it's intentional. I think people are emotional. There's a lot of anger and rage. And when they hear a claim about the other side, they want to spread it quickly so the world can see who they're up against. Traditionally on the Palestinian side, you hear a lot of like indiscriminately targeting civilians. You sometimes have seen photos and videos surface from like Syria, and say that that's happening in Israel. Specifically this time around, there's been a few claims on the Israeli side that have really spread like wildfire. And then when people are called out about them, they don't retract them. They say, well, what's really the difference? So let me give you an example. There was the claim that 40 babies were beheaded. And I don't know if that's a lie that was intentionally spread. What I think may have possibly happened is I think the initial report said 40 babies and children were taken out on gurneys. Again, some were mutilated and beheaded, right? So this could potentially be there was a single baby beheaded, other babies killed, other children killed, and the children could be anybody under 18. And that very quickly spread to 40 babies beheaded. Now, once people pushed back and said this didn't happen, then instead of acknowledging that they spread misinformation, they said, well, what's really the difference between 40 children killed and 40 babies beheaded? And it's true that on a moral level, it's not much of a big difference. But that being the case, be accurate with your information, because the second you're caught spreading misinformation, you lose credibility on any other claim you're going to make. And actually, any anti-Hamas claim you make or somebody else makes will be questioned more. So it's not really about there being much of a moral difference. It's more about if you want people to take you seriously, if you want people to listen to your claims, you should be accurate with how you're reporting it. I yesterday had a live stream with a friend from Gaza, and I made a false claim. I said so far around 1,000 civilians have been killed. That is not the case. It's probably, we don't know the exact numbers. It's probably half of that. Once someone pointed out that I made a mistake, an Israeli friend of mine who's a researcher, I added a correction on the pinned post on the comment correcting my mistake, right? So I try to be accurate. I also make mistakes. It happens. But if we know a mistake was made, we should go come forth and acknowledge it, because that's how we remain credible. And if we're not credible, what's really the point of doing what we're doing? In terms of it being a lot of outsiders, yeah, you know, there's people like, you know, online influencers. This is the hot topic today. So they want their likes, their clicks, they want to increase their following. So everybody's taking an opinion. Everybody wants to be involved in some way and, you know, be part of this. But often these outside actors just don't help, because they're not speaking messages of peace and reconciliation. They're just supporting one side and just fueling the flames of fear and anger and hate. So my what I would say to outsiders is, if you're not going to be a voice of reason, a voice of peace, then sit down and shut up.
Yeah. I've come across also, I think, other regional or international powers who will use this for advancing whatever agenda they have. So I'll give you a couple of examples. I ended up on an interview on an Indian television, and an Indian military general goes, well, we have to take into account how Pakistan is involved in this. And I went, Pakistan? I don't think even Israel has said Pakistan has anything to do with this. Why are you bringing in Pakistan? I realized, oh, this is an opportunity for everyone to side whoever their foe is, whoever they perceive as their enemy, and get them on the side they see is losing. In this case, you know, the Palestinians are like Pakistan, Palestinian side. They're all Muslim. They all hate everybody not Muslim. And that's the case. I'm like, please, we have enough problems as it is. Getting other countries who are not directly involved in this to be involved, it's awful. It just makes things so much worse. And I think it's happening in other places. You see it in Europe now, people saying, stop immigration because if Muslims keep immigrating to Europe, they're going to do what Hamas is doing. That today, I've read it actually quite a few. This is like a social media thing. I think actually Kissinger just said Germany has made a mistake of letting too many foreigners, he meant really Muslims, into Germany. And suddenly everyone is, whatever your agenda is, let's use let's use Hamas, Palestine, Israel, all of that to advance our own agenda. And it's not because they give a one bit of damn about me and you.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Yep. A lot of the pro-Israel people are just anti-Muslim. A lot of the pro-Palestine people are just anti-Israel or anti-Semitic, or they're just trying to co-opt the conflict to promote their own cause. Yeah. You know, India is an interesting one because there's so many pro-Israel Indians. They're like some of the most pro-Israel and militant voices that you see in comment sections on different videos. Yeah. But Indians also have like a lot of them have this like Hitler fetish. There's a lot of like love for Hitler in India, from what I understood. There's like there's a famous, yeah. And I don't even know if they know like everything Hitler did, but it's interesting that there's these two competing energies there. I don't know if it's the same people, but yeah, it could be because Hitler popularized the swastika, which is
a Hindus.
Exactly. Yeah. But it's not something I've looked into. If anybody in the comments has more information on that. So, you know, it's really hard not to lose hope with everything going on, but what do you really think, what do you think we could do? Like people living on, let's start with people living on the land, and we could also talk about what our governments could do.
I think we need to spread, look, we cannot right now influence the Israeli government or the Palestinian or Hamas, or there's very limited aspect to what you and me can do. But one thing we definitely can do is there is a feeling, and I think when I talk to people who don't know the stories of Israelis and Palestinians being together right now, there is a feeling that, oh, it doesn't exist. There's only one alternative. The alternative is a continuous war. And I think we need to show that there is a third way. We need to show there's an alternative. And that means all of us who can tweet, who can talk to people, who can tell stories. There are so many stories that are heartbreaking right now, but also can lead you to have a little bit of hope. And those are stories I would be spreading. I can tell you one from yesterday where one of the people killed, Chaim Katzman, who is who's also a peace activist, and his family made it very clear that they don't want his death to be used to promote hatred. So his brother was on TV yesterday on CNN, and he said, I just want to make sure people don't take this story and run with it to say, let's go and basically kill more Palestinians. These are the stories we should be highlighting. These are the stories we should be spreading. And that's the least each of us can do right now, is tell a different story. Because everyone else, like no one, we don't need to spread the news of what's really happening, because there are so many people who are doing it. We need to think of what's missing. What's the voices that are missing? Israelis need to see people like me. Palestinians need to see people like you right now. And that's terribly missing. And internationals need to see us together.
Right. Very much agree. Out of everything happening in the continent around Israel and Palestine, how many conversations are there between Israelis and Palestinians? Right. It's almost unheard of. I said this on the stream yesterday because we were talking to Mohammed from Gaza, but I'd like to get to the point where this conversation between us is not interesting because so many people are doing it. Right. People tune into to Sulha because it's so unique. It's novel. Where else can they find Israelis and Palestinians sitting and having a conversation, engaging respectfully? This we should create a world where this is really the norm. I see Leila Adan, you just signed up for membership. Thank you so much. Any contribution helps us do more of this content, so it's very much appreciated. You know, and about what you said, there's so many people spreading like information about how the other side's bad, or a certain type of message of really fear and anger. I've been doing content, and most of my content is focusing on messages that give us hope, things that inspire us, or just a different reconciliatory approach to things. People actually have gotten angry at me, and you know as well as I do, we can't do what we're doing without being hated on. It's impossible. When you humanize someone's enemy, you become the enemy. That's what I've discovered. But people reached out and said, now's not the time to talk peace. Now's not the time for this. Now's the time to show the world how evil Hamas is. And there's millions of people on both sides trying to paint the other side as evil. There's very few trying to give people hope and comfort during these challenging times, right? So obviously we shouldn't apologize for our approach. We need more people doing this. And few recognize that fear and anger doesn't lead us to better decision-making. It leads us to worse decision-making.
I'm thinking, you know, now it's not the time, but also a month ago was not the time because people were if there's no violence, no one is paying attention usually. And so a month ago, no one cared. A year ago, no one cared. And I would get ticket even to governments. Every government in the world is outraged right now. Where was the outrage when they could have come and helped us in this conflict? The U.S. government completely ignored it, believed the status quo is sustainable. Europe completely ignored it, did nothing. And now they are outraged. I think their outrage is late. We don't need people and governments to be outraged only when there is violence. Unfortunately, when the violence dies down, the assumption is that's it. We've solved it. No, we haven't. The time when there is no violence is the time, yeah, to work hard to get to a point where we don't have violence again, where we can find peace, justice, freedom for everyone in this security, for everyone in this land. And unfortunately, it only happens, like again, the outrage. It's either wartime, you can't talk about peace, or it's sustainable conflict. We don't need to talk about peace because there's no violence. So basically, we don't do anything because it's either violence or sustainable quiet. That's right. Two aspects people have. And absolutely no. This is exactly the time for us to speak. This is the time for us to say, this can't continue. It's people's lives. Like, I think we're watching like it's almost a football game and who scores more goal. And now is the time to demonize this or demonize that. This is not a football game. The people I know who are hurt, they're not looking at this. Oh, interestingly, most of the people who lost family members that I personally know have been saying, we don't want revenge. We don't want retaliation. Killing children elsewhere doesn't make our lives better. I know it from my own story. My brother was killed doesn't make me celebrate revenge. This doesn't make you feel better. It makes you feel bitter. And eventually it will hit you that I supported this. I think somewhere, I'd like to believe at least, somewhere in our hearts and our minds, it will hit you at some point if you're supporting killing any civilian, any human being, any person who completely, especially kids. That's why I was seeing all the things happening in Gaza, and I wasn't thinking, oh, I'm Palestinian, these are Israeli, so where does my sympathy have to be? Screw that. That's nonsense. These are kids. These are civilians. My sympathy absolutely with them, whether they're Israeli or Palestinian. My thinking is, this is wrong, period. I don't care. Yeah, I'm anti-occupation. It doesn't justify it. Yes, I'm against injustice toward Palestinians. It doesn't justify it. And vice versa. It works both ways. If we find a way to demonize and dehumanize the other side, then eventually we okay even with genocide.
Right. One of the first steps to genocide is dehumanization.
Right.
Very well said, brother. There's a bunch of comments I'd like to yes. read and address. So this is relevant to what you were saying about viewing life as equal across the board, because Gregory Friedman goes, I feel like you guys are acting as if both sides are equal. So what's interesting about this comment is it's impossible to know which side you're talking about being better and which side you're worse, because this is really what it's all about. I think by your last name, I could assume who I think you think is more just and more moral. But, you know, we look, many who are focused on peace work, right? They look at things through the lens of humanism, and that all life is of equal worth. And that's how conversations like this happen, because it's not like, it's not about pointing fingers and blame. It's about understanding that if we could value life equally and find a path forward that really cherishes life and comes to the table with a solution that not only is practical, but that values human life across the board, then that's really the best path forward. But just to get a little bit deeper on this, why some people, it's not such an obvious statement which side is right and which side is wrong. So many people who are pro-Palestine and anti-Israel, they're like, okay, well, Israel started it, right? It started by Zionists showing up and saying, we're going to have an exclusive homeland, you know, in a land that's inhabited by Palestinians, and we're going to displace them by you know, buying land from the Ottomans and displacing the inhabitants, right? That was the initial injustice that happened here, according to this narrative. So they view Israel as the first aggressor by displacing Palestinians, and then they view Israel as the powerful entity, therefore having more responsibility. And then they look at the civilian death toll, and they see how much worse Palestinians have been killed than Israeli civilians. So, right, when you look at it through that lens, you're like, okay, obviously Israel's the bad guy, Palestine's the good guy. Pro-Israel people, what they see is, they see, okay, well, you know, it's true we're the powerful one, but our intention is to really just live in peace. Their intention is to destroy Israel. So because we're trying to make peace and they keep rejecting it and keep attacking us, obviously we're the good one, we're the bad one. So whether you're pro-Palestine or pro-Israel really depends on which story you're acknowledging and which story you give more, put more emphasis on. But at the end of the day, if we want to find a solution, we need to put pressure on both sides, hold both sides accountable, and have both sides recognize that there's a legitimacy to each other's narratives, and really find the best path forward towards peace and reconciliation. So, you know, you could try to point fingers all day. I don't think that's going to get us any closer to peaceful resolution. Yeah. So, yeah, and Aziz, feel free to build on that.
Yeah, I think what we're talking about is the current crisis, current situation. I think in general, if we were talking in a different time, we'll be talking more probably about the occupation and the system and all of that. And last time we talked, that was more of the conversation. So I think it really depends also on when we talking and what's important at that moment. Right now, what I find most important is what we can do to stop killing. That's, I think, the most important. And that means in Gaza, that means in Israel, that means in the West Bank. I mean, we're talking about Gaza and Israel right now, but there's, what, 20 people being killed in the West Bank in the last week? And those are not in the news at all, because 20 people compared to so many others in Gaza and in the south of Israel, it's not even in the news anymore. So that's really, really what we're trying to do is, how do you stop the killing of a human beings? I see somebody here is asking what's anti-occupation. I think you're referring to Chaim. He was an activist who protested, who came to the West Bank. The whole family is very outspoken against Israel occupation of the West Bank, and obviously the occupation, the siege, I would say, on Gaza before this war. The people I'm talking about who are very active are people I'm protesting in the West Bank. They side by side with me. If we getting beat up by Israeli police, they side by side with me getting beat up. When we go to Sheikh Jarrah, they are standing there, whether it's cold, whether it's raining, whether it's hot, whether the police coming and beating us up. And honestly, when the police comes, it used to be once upon a time, they would hit me, but not hit them. Now they don't really care. They'll hit us equally. Those are my brothers and sisters, because we, you know, we don't, and that's how we should see it. We don't look at, if we look at a system and see injustice, we work toward it together. So this division of us, Palestinian, they, Israeli, doesn't work really with the way we think, because to me, it's those of us for justice and for peace and for working and living and coexisting together, and those of us who are not there and hopefully not there yet? And what can we do to bring others to join us in this endeavor?
So I want to make a little correction. So Gregory clarified, the one who wrote the comment. Wait, can you guys hear that background noise? There's like a lawnmower going. Yeah, hold on. Okay. Just can't trust getting quiet outside, you know? Okay. I shared Gregory's comment about him saying we're speaking as if both sides are equal. And I made a joke. It definitely was a joke about being able to guess what side he's on, because his last name's Friedman, but he clarified that I'm misinterpreting his comment, and Israel has a boot on the Palestinian neck, that he's talking about power. So I stand corrected, Gregory. You seem to be a pro-Palestinian Jew, which is the minority, but yeah. So it was a joke, but I was wrong in my assumption.
Another question?
Yeah, I'm going to take more, yeah. But I do want to, you know, on the thing of power, often people make their conclusions on Israel-Palestine based on who has more power, but it's not the only framework in which we need to look at things. It's not only about who has more power. It's also about what is one's intention, like who has a clearer path towards peace. So I'm very critical of Israel and think Israel could do a lot more to bring us closer to peace for two reasons. First of all, Israelis can vote. So Israeli citizens actually have a say in politics to a much larger extent than Palestinians do. Israel's government and military is much more powerful, so they could dictate a lot of things on the ground. And Aziz, this might even be an area of disagreement between us, but let me know what you think. That being said, it's unclear what actions Israel could take to achieve peace. Right, you hear a lot of slogans, end the siege in Gaza. Well, why would Israel do that when Hamas's intent is not just for the siege to end? They want to destroy Israel. So why would Israel allow them to import endless amounts of weapons so they could just continue to fight Israel? Right. So ending the siege isn't going to give us peace. It's just going to put Jewish lives in danger. Or another slogan we often hear is end the occupation, which would be great. But what does it mean to end the occupation? Do we unilaterally pull out of the West Bank? So there's 500,000 Jewish citizens there. Do we pull them out? Let's say we do. It would be bloody, but let's say we do that. Very shortly after, Hamas will likely take over the West Bank. They are more popular there. You then have a situation similar to in Gaza, where you have a terrorist organization that is the ruling government that's intent on destroying Israel. So Israel could end the occupation. They could end the siege, but that's not going to make them safe. So the slogans are easy to say, and it's easy to look at who has more power, but what is the simplest path towards peace? And it's really, and I know this is easier said than done, but if Palestinians were to, in a sense, swallow their pride, accept the situation for what it is, and accept peace with Israel, then that's probably the easiest path forward. And that really is in Palestinian hands, despite them lacking power. But Aziz, I'm interested in hearing what you think on this, this is one of my most controversial takes as a peacemaker. So
yeah, I think in the 1990s, beginning of 1990s, when Israelis and Palestinian leaders were able to come together and form an agreement, good or a bad agreement, we can argue about how good or bad was Oslo in hindsight, but vast majority of Israelis and vast majority of Palestinians ended up supporting it, even though if you checked a year earlier, the majority would have said no. And the moment there was an agreement, majority of people supported it. There was an election after in the Palestinian side, and actually Hamas didn't win, which was, it was back then Fatah who won the election, and there was a strong showing for third parties at that time. The worse things have gotten, violence, anger, hate, the more people started voting for parties who don't support peace, whether that be Hamas or in Israel, it would be, Otzma Yehudit or Jewish Power and Likud and so on. And these groups not interested in ending the occupation, to the point, I don't think even if Palestinians came and said, we'll take whatever deal you give us with the current government, Israel, I don't think it would have worked. And I'm thinking of specifically Netanyahu saying in 2019, it was reported by Haaretz that we need to strengthen Hamas. This is the words of Netanyahu. We need to strengthen Hamas so we can kill the two-state solution. Or Smotrich, who is the minister of finance, who has a lot of power in the military and probably somewhat responsible for why the military wasn't in Gaza this last week and was in the West Bank. He said, Hamas is a blessing for us. That's, to me, is unbelievable, but I understand them, because if you want to stay in power as a radical, you need somebody radical on the other side to justify your presence as a radical. And so that's how that cycle continues, where we need to push to change in our politics, but we need also a couple of leaders who are brave and willing to move forward and do something about an agreement. It's definitely more complicated than it sounds. I don't think it's very simple. But all of us have to look at what we've done. You know, what was our role into this? I think in some ways we say, who has the blood in their hand? We all do. We all do because of the leadership we allow to rule us or we vote for. We all do as internationals for ignoring things when it's quiet and waiting until things go out of hand. We all do as governments where, you know, I'm hearing comments in the U.S. go like political people who have influence talking about like bomb them all and finish them and things like that. And it's terrifying. That's a blood on these people's head.
Yep. Very well stated. A few more comments. Akil was surprised to learn that 50% of Gaza are kids. So children would be the correct term, meaning under 18. So yeah, 50% of Gaza are 18 or younger. Josh Lurie asks, does Aziz know if Palestinians are aware that attacks were against civilians? So yeah, let me give some context. One of the most interesting things of yesterday's live stream with Muhammad is that he seemed genuinely surprised to discover that civilians were targeted in the attacks. He said in Gaza on the news, they're reporting that it's only militants, only soldiers. Now, I shared this on Twitter and people started pushing back saying it's on social media. They're uploading videos of women being killed, the grandma that was taken hostage. So what do you know of that? What do Palestinians, and I imagine there's a difference between what Palestinians in the West Bank know and believe and what they think and believe in Gaza. But what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think a lot of Palestinians don't believe that civilians were killed and believe it was an Israeli propaganda. And there's a couple of ways you can look at that. But one of it is many cannot comprehend that a Palestinian would do that. So their way of dealing with it is saying, this is propaganda, this is not true. There were no civilians hurt. So there's a couple of videos of Israeli civilians talk about how the Hamas militants who walked in were very nice to them and treated them well. And those are all over Palestinian social media, Arabic social media, televisions. So to a lot of people, they think we don't trust Israeli media, we don't trust what we hear, and therefore it must be propaganda. And there's no way we would do that. We're much better than Israelis. We don't kill children. That's very much the common, I would say, a lot of people in the West Bank, people more, a little bit more exposed to Israeli narrative. So more people aware, at least, of the arguments of that there are different takes or different stories between the Palestinian narrative here and what happened. And then when you come toward Jerusalem and toward the Palestinians within Israel, they're much more aware of what happened. And you hear a lot of condemnations, including from Ayman Oudeh, Ahmad Tibi. These are hard critics of Israel, and yet they were very hardcore in their condemnation. Mm. Also, I mean, the craziness of all of this, you have a Palestinian Israeli citizen who was hurt badly, who's a ambulance driver, and he was shot by Hamas militant. These stories are slowly coming out in the Palestinian media. You have 40 people in the Negev who are Arabs who are killed, including children. Actually, the death didn't only, it wasn't only Israeli Jews who were killed. There were also Arabs, Bedouins, Palestinians who were killed in the south and killed by Hamas. There's a guy from East Jerusalem who I saw. I haven't confirmed this, but I saw his photo on some Facebook groups and on East Jerusalem Facebook groups saying he was working, I think, somewhere in either one of the kibbutzes or in Sderot, and he was taken as one of the hostages. We still don't know if he's missing, if he's killed, if he's a hostage. When I read it, I haven't seen updates yet. These things, as they come out, I think people will learn more about what really happened. But yeah, a lot of people definitely don't
believe. Yeah. Which is really all the more reason why we need to be having conversations across the border, because it's an opportunity to educate one another. Cool. So another comment from Akil. Akil goes, Adar, it sounds like what you're saying is Palestinians are not trustworthy and accept the boot on their neck. Are all Palestinians Hamas? So that's not what I'm saying or implying at all. When Israelis ask me, what can we actually do? How can we have peace? And this is me thinking deeply on the issue. I can't give any clear path in which Israel can solve the conflict. I can give ideas at how we could make the conflict more manageable, right? So for example, we could hold soldiers accountable in the West Bank if they abuse their power. We could also change it from a military force to a civilian police force of adults and not like 18, 19, 20 year olds who speak Arabic and treat Palestinians with dignity and respect. I think that would go a long way to change the environmental conditions of Palestinians. I think we could teach Israelis Arabic so they could communicate with Palestinians. I think we could teach the Palestinian narrative in our schools to make our population more oriented towards peace. I think there's other good faith efforts we could do with releasing maybe nonviolent prisoners, right? So there's a lot Israel could do to make the conflict more manageable. I still can't tell you exactly what Israel can do to solve the conflict. If you were to ask me, what can Palestinians do to solve the conflict? I actually have a clear answer that comes to mind. And feel free to challenge this and broaden my perspective. But what can Palestinians do to solve the conflict? It would be to accept that Israel's not going anywhere, to denounce violence and start working with Israel as, as a legitimate entity. And that would actually solve the conflict. Palestinian oppression is a result of Jewish insecurity, right? The more unsafe Jews feel, the more Palestinians are oppressed. Israel is always going to value the lives and security of Jews over that of Palestinians. And again, you can say this is inherently racist. You can make that claim, but this is the reality, and I'm trying to ground my solutions in reality. So if we can get a situation where Jews living on the land don't feel like they're in danger, don't feel like Palestinians are intent on destroying Israel, then the boot will be lifted off the neck, right? So this is really where I'm coming from. And again, feel free to challenge me, anybody in the comments, but
I'll challenge you a little bit. Cool. Make it a bit more.
Let's go.
Yeah. I agree with you about the need of Israelis feeling that we're not coming out to kill every Jew. I think that's very, very important. I also think until there's a clear path to freedom for Palestinians, this will continue. And the justification for violence against Israelis will continue. I look at why Hamas became powerful. In 2007, after their coup in Gaza, they actually were extremely unpopular. Extremely unpopular. And they didn't become popular until their first encounter and first round of violence with Israel. And the reason they did, I remember still, that after it, Hamas was able to secure some concessions from Israel. They were able to come to the Palestinians and say, look, after this, usually after some money will come in to rebuild, some money will come in to do this, some supplies will be allowed in, and so on. And so they would look to people in Gaza and say, look, we fight, we succeed to bring something. While in the same time, you look at the dude in Ramallah, Abu Mazen, who says, I'm against violence, I want to work with Israel, I want to make a peace agreement. And they said, look at him. He's negotiating with the Israelis and he's getting nothing. And that's, I think, big part almost of what Netanyahu said as well. The more you strengthen Hamas, you weaken the Palestinian Authority, more Palestinians right. become convinced that violence is the only way you can get Israel to make concessions. The Palestinian Authority today is seen as traitors to Palestinians.
Right.
Though there is a conversation today between, say, Netanyahu staying in power, between Netanyahu and Abu Mazen, who I do not like whatsoever, but assuming these terrible leaders we have can do it. If there's a conversation today between them, and that conversation leads to really clear steps of how we're going to get out of where we are, you will see the popularity of the PA shoots up the roof. If people feel something affecting their life, it will change the direction, just like in the time of Rabin and Arafat when they were negotiating. I think you will see a big shift. I believe if Rabin wasn't assassinated, we would not have been where we are today. I really think if Netanyahu did not win the elections back in 96, 95, we would not be where we are today.
Right. Yeah, I agree with that. And I think you make a great point is that what would help Palestinians accept Israel as a legitimate entity is if there's a clear path forward, give them hope as to what to work towards when our government is to a large extent responsible for the continued radicalization of the Palestinians.
Yeah, I read the most recent poll among Palestinians about violence, and there was a support for Palestinian militant groups, and that's usually what pro-Israel people will say. Look, there's support that there'll be militant groups that fight Israel. True. Mm-hmm. But if you read between the lines why there was that support, it's attacks on Hawara, which happened in the last year. It's attacks of settlers that are go completely unchallenged, pretty much. And so the Palestinians go, the Palestinian Authority cannot defend us. At least Hamas does, militant groups do. And so we need these militant groups to defend us against Israel or against settlers, against violence. And that keeps rolling. And the Palestinian Authority, even there was a question like if there is a major violence between Israel and in the West Bank, Israel and Palestinians in the West Bank, do you think Palestinian Authority will protect its residents? And vast majority of Palestinians said, no, they'll probably hide. That's why we need militants. That's why I'm saying the more we weaken the Palestinian Authority, you will see major rise for militant groups because they've seen as a group to fulfill the void that exists by the Palestinian Authority. And I say that not to say I love the Palestinian Authority. I am a major critic of who they are and what they do, just like you're probably a critic of the Israeli government. I think we need elections for sure. I think being in power for 20 years, almost 20 years, 18 years for Abbas without being challenged in election is ridiculous. But in the same time, I don't want him to be challenged in elections right now. If there is an election, I want at least something politically that gives some power to those who want peaceful settlement. So it gives people a reason to vote for somebody, you know, who would support what I'm talking about. Right now, there is no reason for people to vote for someone like me.
I mean, isn't it so challenging, right? Because the PA can't claim to be legitimate without elections. But if there were elections, then they would likely lose. And they also, it's hard for them to, they're not going to be popular because they're currently propped up by Israel, right? The PA's existence is a result of Israel letting them continue to exist. So how could they ever be popular if that's the case? So it's like, how do you even break that tension until you run for office, you know?
I've tried. You're right. I mean, they need to have some kind of power, some kind of independence from Israel and not be seen only as Israel's security guards, which is how most Palestinians view them right now. And the reason things haven't gone as bad in the West Bank in the last few days as they are in Gaza, and why there hasn't been, people going and shooting at settlements in great numbers and so on, which could have, is because the Palestinian Authority is really guarding those settlements in some ways. It's not the Israeli military that's stopping it. It is the Palestinian Authority. And that making people think they're traitors, because in return, they don't know what they're getting. They don't see what they're getting. They're like, we have a radical government in Israel, therefore, what are we getting in return?
Right, right.
And that's what needs to change. With it, needs to change the people in power. The average leader in the West Bank today is over 70 years old. Only 1% of Palestinians, I think, under 30 years old, have any say in leadership in Palestine. That needs absolutely to change as well.
Right.
Because, you know, most Palestinians are under 35 years old. I'm too old already for most Palestinians.
Aziz, do you have more time? We're closing it now. Yeah, okay, so we'll continue. So Max Slomov is asking me, Adar, why do you claim that all Palestinians deny the right of Israel to exist? I never claimed that, bro. You could look back. There's certainly Palestinians that recognize Israel. The challenge is that the powerful entity, the controlling entity in Gaza, Hamas, and the most popular entity in the West Bank, also Hamas, not controlling, but currently the most popular, they deny Israel's right to exist. So for Israel to just let things unfold and let Hamas take power, be as powerful as they possibly can be, is just not a realistic solution. And I'll continue with another comment since we're already talking.
Can I actually address one comment?
Yeah, sure.
Unless you have something similar.
Or just one more, because it's just Max. Max did him. So Max, you're asking if I think Israel has a responsibility to do everything on what I listed to relieve tension. 100% Israel needs to do their utmost to bring us closer to peaceful resolution. There's no denying that. And I've been saying this on this channel for years. And then can't you see how that's different from spreading further into occupied territory? Of course. Max, I have a feeling this might be your first time tuning in. So before like jumping to conclusions about what you think I believe, just listen, because you keep reaching these conclusions that are just so far from true. I've never once thought expanding territories is a good policy. But I'm glad we have a new viewer, and welcome. Yeah, Aziz, take any comment you'd like.
I want to take the comment, how do we get you on outlets, you two on outlets with bigger reach? And I want to really take this one, because it is very frustrating how hard it is with people I know, Israelis, Palestinians, or American Jews, Arabs, who supportive of what we're talking about, to get on bigger media. I can tell you, I've been in touch with a few this week. You know, people are talking in the U.S., where are the Palestinians who are saying what Hamas did is wrong? I've talked to quite a few media outlets. Majority are not interested in putting that on. Majority don't want to hear that. They'll talk to me and say, oh, this sounds really good. We feel bad for what happened and for you and the people you know. But very few outlets were interested. I can tell you, big TV shows, I've talked to their producers, they're looking for the Palestinian to go out and argue and fight and debate, and which is something I'm not interested
in. Right, right, right.
They want me basically to be the angry Palestinian.
Right.
Honestly, I have a feeling in American media, that's what they look for, an angry Palestinian. Somebody who's, you know, somebody who's hurt, somebody who's like feeling really devastated right now, but they don't want somebody who comes and challenge the narrative that who Palestinians are. And that's after talking to like people in all the major outlets and in newspapers as well. for me to write, like, I want to write what we're talking about in an article, I know majority of outlets won't even respond to me. I have to fight. And I have a PR person. I have a company. So I have a PR person who knows all of these. And she's doing her best to get those voices out. Instead of promoting our business now, she's actually, you know, we switched all our work to focus on spreading this message. It's not easy to get our message out. So what can be done is, you, people who are listening, should be writing to these outlets and saying, here's an example of what we want to see on TV. You need to change what's on TV. We don't want to only hear angry people all the time, analysts only all the time. We want to hear also a message of hope. Here are some examples. And that's a way they'll respond to you much more than they unfortunately would respond to me calling them and say, hey, I want to say something that's different than what you've been saying. And they're like, eh. Not important.
Right. So I actually had similar experience. You know, I've been on Israeli news a few times and I think I was just too nice. I wasn't argumentative enough because, oops, hold on, I'm getting a call coming. I really need to learn to turn off these notifications on my computer for these live streams. Sorry for all the dings and dongs. But yeah, they never called me back after a few times. It was just too nice. I wouldn't argue the way they wanted me to. BCFC Ireland says, sounds like you want a more humanitarian occupation. That's based on the comments I made earlier. So I think, you know, I'm happy you bring this up because I think this is where a lot of activists go wrong. There's a very all or nothing mentality. No, what I really want is peace on the land. I want Palestinians to enjoy the same rights and freedoms as Israelis. I want us both to be secure and have the ability for prosperity and freedom on this land. But I'm going to take small steps if they can be presented, right? So there's a constant battle between the idealist and the world we want to create and the realist understanding what's a viable next step. So I'm not going to deny a more humanitarian occupation if it's better than a less humanitarian occupation. Obviously, I'd prefer something else, but let's take any progress we could get because progress is good. It's good for human life. So don't let the idealist in you stop you from making progress in this conflict. You see any other comments you want to
add? I can look.
And Aziz, I want to put you on the spot for a moment because you're such a voice of reason. I'd like for you to be a regular on the show and even a co-host. So to the point where you can come do a live stream with other Israelis, other people. I don't know how much free time you have and you don't need to answer me now, but I'm setting an intention. I think this channel could be brought to the next level if there was more Palestinian energy in it. And your energy is the exact energy we need. So think about it and let me know.
Thank you. The Palestinians evacuating North Gaza to the south were met by, what is it? Has the topic of what happened this morning been discussed? I honestly haven't yet read about civilians evacuating North Gaza and going south were met by IDF and killed. I can't comment on that because I haven't yet read it. And I do think I can tell you that people being asked to leave North Gaza, we're talking about 1 million people in 24 hours. It's almost impossible because going to South Gaza, it's already the most crowded place in probably the world. To take half of Gaza and tell everyone to move to the other half is almost impossible. And it could be a major disaster already. Even without the story you just wrote, which I'll need to read it. But yeah, it would be a major disaster. I think it's terrifying what could happen in Gaza in the next couple of days.
Yeah, I agree completely. And I'm not sure what their actual goal here is. Is it just to create such a humanitarian crisis that it causes Hamas to release the prisoners, possibly? Or are they actually saying our goal now is to actually defeat Hamas? And if Israel, this is a controversial take, but if Israel can defeat Hamas and change the status quo for the better, then the case could be made that they're that their actions are now justified. In the long term, we would be able to look back and say, you know what? If that created peace in Palestine, then it's good. But the chance of that actually happening is low. What we're seeing is the chance of mass civilian casualties is certain. The chance of it actually achieving the goal of defeating Hamas is low. So it's very hard to see this as the right approach. Although the majority of Israelis and pro-Israeli people are very happy with this approach because we're hardwired for retribution, tit for tat. We're furious, we're scared, or people believe this will actually make a difference this time, but I'm not sure.
I was listening to an analyst, Daniel Levy, who was involved in negotiations before, and he was talking about how it literally, he was explaining how it literally is almost impossible. You might be to defeat fully Hamas, even if you go full land invasion, even if Israel reoccupies Gaza. It's very hard because you're not talking about normal military. This is state to state war. And you might be able to get in and take over just like the U.S. took over Afghanistan. And you can hang kind of what Bush did, a mission accomplished on top of
exactly
Gaza and say, we took it.
That was the beginning.
Wait 3 more months and you'll find out, okay, we back to first point. This is why I don't, and what we've been saying, people who do peace work, I've worked in Afghanistan, so I've seen this firsthand. Mm. It is absurd almost, and I am not saying this to say Taliban is good because they've also killed friends of mine and they're horrible. It is absurd, though, that Taliban's able to hold security today better in Afghanistan than the U.S. did when they were there. Absurd, but that's a reality. They abusing women, they're doing a lot of things horrible, but in the sense, I know people who now travel to Afghanistan and say, and they used to run tours before, and now it's people who crazy want to go to travel to Afghanistan right now, but they'll say it's safer now because we never worry about any bomb exploding on a daily basis, where when I was in Kabul, literally you walk anywhere and you think, I might get shot, I might get blown up every minute. I'll go to meetings and think somebody could bomb us right now. Our hotel was attacked multiple times. And so I take that experience from Afghanistan, I think about Gaza, and yeah, Israel might think we can go in, we can take over. In reality, it wouldn't solve it. This is a political issue and a humanitarian issue, and it needs to be solved that way. Without figuring out a political settlement for this, we will continue in some way or another. We might have a quiet for a year, for two, for three, but it's not gonna solve the issue. And even if you get, which is one of the popular opinions now, let's get a lot of Gazans into Sinai. Yeah, but Sinai is right next to Israel too. So like then next time you have to go and invade Sinai. I'm hearing that the U.S. has asked Egypt to get involved and maybe go in and fight with Israel, which Egypt can't. If they do that, it would be the Egyptian government would be facing major uprising within Egypt against the government. And they're not going to sacrifice their own government, their own rule for this. There isn't really any solution, I think, with violence. That's my analysis.
Yeah, you know, you really make a great case that we should get back to the negotiating table.
Yeah. And again, you know how close we were. It is not an impossible. I think people keep saying it's impossible to come to a solution. A year ago, I, by accident, ended up hearing from Ehud Olmert. And I got to ask him how close really we were. And he was like, we were at the final steps. We were almost there. And he argued if he wasn't, indicted, we would have had peace today. which you hear that and you go, for goodness sake, I don't care about his corruption charges. It's not like Bibi isn't corrupt. If it was that close to a peace agreement, I could have left with a corrupt Israeli prime minister for an extra year and got a peace agreement. He's like, we were so close. We were talking about the final elements of a peace agreement. And him and Abu Mazen apparently got along really met over, 20 some times. And so close. And yet it didn't happen. So we're not so far. If we have the right leadership, and Olmert is not a left-wing hardcore activist at all. He's a Likud. He's from the same party of Netanyahu. We were so close. And that's just so depressing to know how close we were. And we are today where we are because we could not finalize those agreements.
Right.
And by the way, that's before Hamas took over. Basically, like Hamas would have been, would not be where it is today if that happened.
Yeah, it's just now the population is even more radicalized, right? So if we currently have the most right-wing government in Israel's history, the next government might be even more right-wing after what just transpired. So it's hard not to lose hope, but the reason we need to remain hopeful is because with no hope, you can't achieve anything, right? Any solution you want starts with believing that it's possible. So we should set an intention and have a belief in what we know is possible, and then find ways to work towards that, even if right now it's hard to see how that can happen. And, you know, we're all human, so it's not like we could be hopeful all the time. You know, I try to stay hopeful, but sometimes I really don't have much hope. But I remind myself that hope is the motivator we need to improve the world we're living in.
I'm reading the comments to see if we missed any.
Yeah, maybe I'm going to read Ido Rothbaum's comment. It is in Hebrew, so I'm going to translate it. So the anger in Israel is so great now that even the left supports the occupation of Gaza and the destruction of Hamas. The right is...
You need help translating?
No. Okay. Even the left supports conquering Gaza now in Israel. He's saying the left supports it in order to put the Palestinian Authority in there, and the right supports staying there. So that's interesting. I actually haven't seen what public opinion on the ground is. Okay. Interesting.
Yeah,
I just don't know what I mean. Time will tell.
No, I mean it's probably true that in time of war, people become very tribal, and they become very my side, my people, and they have a hard time. You know, we become very focused on revenge, and it's very hard to get out of that dynamic. So even people I know and respect and people I care about, I see some online posting awful stuff because they've, you know, they emotionally hit and they don't know how to respond to it except with anger. I'm trying not to judge anybody because I'm hoping this is just those first couple of days. And I can already see some people on the first day were like, let's go kill everyone. And 4 or 5 days later now are coming down from that stand. But yeah, we all become angry when atrocities happen. And then especially if you only see things happening in your own side, so you don't understand the pain on the other side. So,
right.
But we can't make, I think what's important, one, we cannot make policies based on emotions. You can't really do that. You can make policies based on need of vengeance because the results of that will be worse than where we are today. And that's how we functioned so many times. It hasn't done good for us. So I would say we should definitely avoid that as much as we can.
Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting you made that point, because I'm actually, I just wrote a little post this morning that I'm going to release either today or tomorrow. That's all about the fact that our policies on both sides are a result of emotion and not actually thoughtful, not really thoughtful. And it's actually harder to have thoughtful policy than we think, because it doesn't just require our leadership to be thoughtful. They very well may know that this strategy is ineffective, but the people are emotional. And in order to be popular and stay relevant in politics, you need to do what the people want, right? Mm-hmm. So even if like Bibi can assess that our airstrike policy in Gaza is not effective, it's counterproductive, maybe he knows that deep down, the Israeli public expects retaliation, right? So it would almost be political suicide for him to do something more sensible. Makes it a lot more challenging.
Which is
more the reason why we need to have these conversations, start to change the conversation amongst people. Somebody's asking, and after this, we'll wrap it up. But how much of the divide is due to language divide? We're speaking in English, but it seems the real conversations need to happen in Hebrew and Arabic. So Josh Lurie, this is a great point. The actually most spoken common language between both sides, I think, is actually English. So it's the most relevant to reach both, but you're 100% right that there needs to be similar conversations in Hebrew and Arabic, and we need to somehow get to a point where we can speak each other's language, because that's really going to be very hard to make peace with somebody who you can't communicate with, you know?
I used to host a radio show many, many years back in Arabic and Hebrew, and it was a challenge to translate. I used to translate everything mm-hmm. Arabic and Arabic to Hebrew. I had an Israeli co-host with me, Sharon Meshaiker, and we would interview every week one Israeli and one Palestinian. I'd love to see something like this happen again. I think there is definitely a place. It's a slower form of media when you have to translate everything. We still had an average, I think back then, about 30,000 people listening every week, which is huge for a small country like Israel and Palestine. Many who listened to learn, which was a challenge because they had to trust my Hebrew and my translation from Arabic to Hebrew to learn. But I think, yes, there is definitely a place for that. And I agree with you, Dora. I think English is definitely an important language. But the problem isn't the language we're speaking. The problem is the language in the sense how we understand the language, how we understand what we're talking to each other. Like when we talk about any topic, we hear it differently. Even words we hear differently. We interpret, we think, we feel differently with different words we're talking about. So when Adar is talking about Israeli military, Israeli soldiers, Israeli, all of that, I'm assuming many of your friends, Adar, are in the army. Many of people you know are there, some maybe being killed fighting in the army, so on. So it's a feeling of what pride, family, friendship. When a Palestinian hears Israeli army, it makes you defensive. It makes you think of checkpoints. It makes you think of what's happening in Gaza. It makes you think of killing. It makes you afraid. Mm-hmm. And so even when we speak in the same language, the challenge isn't necessarily what language, it's how can we communicate where we able to listen to each other, regardless of what language we're hearing, and we're able to understand the emotions that come with what we're saying. We're able not to focus on what do I want to tell you, but rather how can I get what I want to tell you to you in a way you can listen to me, and how can I listen to you when you're telling me what you're trying to say, and maybe I'm not fully understanding the meaning behind it. Giving the other a lot of benefit of the doubt rather than quickly jumping into conclusions. That's really the challenge with language we have. It's bigger mm-hmm. than just Hebrew and Arabic.
Beautiful point, and I'd like to build on that. If we can't use language that the other side is open to hearing, then we're not going to effectively communicate to them. And also, you need to know your audience. So let me give you a clear example, right? Like the West Bank is occupied. It's occupied territories. But there's many Israelis that you say occupied territories, done. You're irrelevant. So I won't say Palestinians living in occupied territories. I'll say Palestinians living under another nation's military rule. That's undeniable, right? It's describing a similar situation, but in a way that isn't triggering and making Israelis defensive. And then there's like the concept of trying to build this like unified narrative and set slogans and whatnot. So you often hear people say Zionism is settler colonialism. But Zionists will say Zionism is an indigenous rights movement. Well, I think Zionism is an indigenous rights movement that used settler colonial tactics to achieve its goals, right? Seems to be a little bit of both worlds, angers both sides a little bit, but also gives both sides something that they think they could probably agree with, right? So if we could think of more ways to tell the story of the people of Israel and Palestine that the people of Israel and Palestine can hear and listen to, we're going to be that much closer. So yeah,
we can start a dictionary of what every word means for Israelis and for Palestinians.
Interesting. Should we work on that?
Yeah, sounds good.
Okay. Cool. So we're going to wrap it up. I know there are more questions, but we're both extremely busy. You know, I run a company. So does Aziz. This isn't our full time. But Aziz, you want to leave us with some final words? Where can people find you? I linked your Twitter on the...
Yeah, you can go to my personal website as well. It's azizabosera.com, just my name. Feel free to reach out. And if you ever want to travel when all of this over, that's my business. I do travel. So it's mejdi.com, M-E-J-D-I. You can find it on my personal website as well. But I'll leave you with this. One of my favorite stories is from an Israeli author named Yehuda Amichai. And not Yehuda Amichai, actually, Amos Oz, a different story. It's Yehuda Amichai, Amos Oz. And he says, if you're walking by a building and you see it on fire, you have three options of what you do. And I think in some ways, looking at what's happening today, it's the country on fire, Israel, Palestine. You have three options to do. The first one is to run away and basically say, it's not my issue. I don't care. Let it all burn. In reality, even if you think it's not your issue, though, it is. Fire spreads. That's the thing about fire. Even if you live in the States, what's happening in Israel, Palestine is affecting us everywhere. Even if you live in Europe, even it does spread, and hate has no limit. So the second option, which is probably, I would say, one of the most popular, is you create a committee to investigate who started or how should we blame for the fire. The problem with that option is by the time you decide who to blame for a fire, everybody in the building would be dead. And that's often what happens on Twitter. That's often what happens on social media. That's what we often do is we feel if I blame the right person, then I've done enough. I've done my part. Then I don't need to do anymore. And then he says there's a third option is you get a bucket, you fill it with water, and you throw it on the fire. But what if you don't have a bucket? So you get a cup, a glass, you fill it with water, and you throw it on the fire. But what if you don't have a glass? You get a spoon, you fill it with water, and you throw it on the fire. Now, would one person with a spoon be able to put out a fire? Obviously not. But the thing is, if each one of us can figure out what is it that we have, do we have a cup? Do we have a bucket? Do we have a spoon? What is it that we can do to put out this fire? That's the way of thinking we should be having. There is a fire. How do we put it out? Rather than who do we blame? How can I get myself out of this situation? Why do I care? You see a fire, you want to try to put it out. And that's my hope. If there's something you want to leave this conversation with, think about what's your spoon? What is it you can do to help us? And it might be simple. It might be spreading these stories of Israelis and Palestinians willing to work together. It might be really, really simple stuff, but it means a lot. And it is, if enough people carry their spoons, a lot can change.
Beautifully said, and such a great way to end this. Aziz, thank you so much. Thank you, everybody tuning in. We don't have our next live stream scheduled yet, but it very well may be tomorrow. We're going to be trying to do updates a few times a week at the very least. And Aziz, I have a strong feeling we'll be seeing you again soon. Thank you all. Stay safe. Sending love.